KaiserNetwork.org.
I am delighted to speak with you today on such a wonderful and important occasion as the closing session of the Clinton Global Initiative. The mission of this gathering and the problems you have all pledged to fight compel me to join you here today in support of your efforts. I first wanted to applaud my friend Bill Clinton and his vision and determination to convene this audience and mobilize a new force to address the greatest challenges the world faces at the start of the 21st century. I commend you for accepting President Clinton's call to action. The Clinton Global Initiative is a tremendously unique and critical gathering of human beings committed to move from rhetoric to action. Action on an unprecedented scale. This initiative is a global movement where every word spoken, every partnership discovered, and every promise made can have a direct impact on the lives of millions of people across our planet for generations to come. We must ask ourselves the question, what can I do as a global citizen? Your commitments can become a powerful tool in shaping a better world, and the results they achieve hold much promise and hope for us all. I thank you most sincerely for your commitment. Let us combine our efforts to ensure a peaceful future for our children. And now it is my pleasure to introduce the man who has made this opportunity for so much promise possible, my dear friend, former President Bill Clinton.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. This session will bring CGI to a close, but I can't help thinking just a moment about the commitments that were made last year that have been kept, my gratitude for them, and the new beginnings that many of you have brought to life in the last 3 days. It's hard for me to say this without a little bit of a smile, but as of now, we have 215 commitments from about twice that many people, and the value my staff swears is $7.3 billion. I I can't thank you enough for your commitments, large and small, and I ask both all the attendees here and the press not to forget that over the past years, some of our smaller dollar commitments have had some of the biggest positive human impact, and that time and talents are actually priceless gifts. I thank you who participated in the plenaries, the smaller groups, the tabletop discussions. I'd like to thank our CGI staff and literally the hundreds of volunteers. I think they did a phenomenal job this year, and I'd like for you all to express your appreciation. I want to thank the sponsors, the participants, the moderators, the panelists, and the people who every year work behind the scenes to help us conceive of and put together all the discussions. An enormous amount of time and effort goes into preparing how we will structure every one of these sessions and who will participate. And it is a special burden for all those who do it that they have to deal with me because I'm such a nitpicker about such things. So I thank all of them. I thank the heads of state and government who come here. I'd like to thank our First Lady Laura Bush again and the other dignitaries who joined us. I want to welcome and thank all the participants and those bloggers that have helped the world follow this, and over 50,000 viewers from around the world who helped to make this a truly global initiative by following it every day over the internet. This morning I want to ask each of the working group chairs to share a little bit about the proceedings and the commitments. You should know there's still a lot of activity going on. There are probably well over 100 potential commitments that will come to fruition in the next few weeks after we go home. And I want to tell you about a couple of developments that have happened just in the last few hours. First, this is really important. I am very grateful that Google is generously offering to make available advertising or sponsorship credits of up to $480,000 a year to every NGO that makes a commitment. They can use the credits to leverage the power of the internet to enlist volunteers, to raise funds, to disseminate information worldwide. And I think we should thank Larry Page and Sergey Brin, who are here. Let's give them a round of applause. Thank you very much. Thanks, guys. It is legendary how much money these young men who barely look old enough to shave made when they took their company public. Most people wait until they are much, much older to begin to give away what they have made. They have already dedicated a huge amount of money to their own charitable activities, way over $1 billion, and I thank them for that as well. Asha and Raj Rajaratnam, trustees of the America India Foundation, a group that I helped to start back in 2001 after the Gujarat earthquake, have just made a commitment of $1.5 million to build the capacity of the healthcare system in India to effectively combat the HIV/AIDS epidemic by providing increased access for pregnant women to get tested and treated for AIDS, and by reaching 100,000 vulnerable adults and children with prevention education. Our foundation does a lot of work in India, and it's really important that groups like this get out and reach people at the grassroots level. Unfortunately, there's still a lot of stigma there. Richard Gere's reached a lot of people in the entertainment industry there to try to help overcome the stigma, but when I was there last, a small family tried to commit family suicide because they were all HIV positive, and the people they passed on the street in their little village actually thought if they were breathed on, they could be infected. So we're making great strides. The government there has been actually quite good, but we need this kind of support. So let's thank Asha and Rosh and the America India Foundation. It's important. This is a story about how this meeting is supposed to work. Nigel Green actually visited our commitments desk looking for a partnership opportunity. He wound up pledging $100,000 to help fund the Microcredit Summit campaign to enroll and train the world's 20 largest microfinance institutions in measuring progress above the $1 a day threshold. Grameen Bank and BRAC, two other organizations who have made commitments already, are on board with the Microcredit Summit idea, but this is the way I wanted this to work. He showed up and said, I want to spend some money in a way that will have a high probability of a good return in an area I care about, and he found this project. So let's give him a round of applause. Working together with Americans for Informed Democracy, Jim Zogby, the president of the Arab American Institute, is committing to do 4 live interactive television programs with participating audiences on 4 American campuses and campuses in the Arab world to increase this very important dialogue among the young. I think this is important, if for no other reason, as I said when we started here with in commenting about the Young Arab Leaders organization, there is a whole other Arab world out there. And if we could just get one story about that world for every 2 bad stories that inevitably have to be printed because somebody's getting killed, we would all be way ahead. So thank you, Jim Zogby. And ladies and gentlemen, give him a hand. I think that's great. Scott Garrett, the president of Beckman Coulter, Inc., is committing at least $100,000 a year to develop a grant program for research and development of new diagnostic tests, methods, or instruments of particular value to people living in developing countries around the world in Africa and elsewhere. One of the really unique contributions of this CGI was that we talked about the collection of infectious diseases that aren't famous, that aren't AIDS, TB, and malaria, that collectively affect tens of millions of people in developing countries all across the globe, and can be assaulted and reversed with relatively modest expenditures. This is a very important commitment, so thank you, Scott Garrett, for doing that. This is a commitment I love. Roger Barnett, the chairman of Shakely Corporation, has made a commitment for his company to become net fully carbon neutral, 100% carbon neutral, all year long from this year through 2011. And instead of doing it by buying carbon credits, although I like the climate exchange very much, Shakely intends to oversee the purchasing and installation of solar energy to provide decentralized electrification to the Millennium Villages that Dr. Jeff Sachs is doing so much to develop. This is a great deal. Thank you very much, Roger, and thank you, Shakely. Now I want to do, as I did last year, call upon the working group chairs to give us a summary of what took place in each subject area and share a few more of the commitments with us. Beginning with our climate change chair, David Sandelow, an environmental scholar at the Brookings Institute, who served as Assistant Secretary of State for Oceans, Environment, and Science, Senior Director for Environmental Affairs at the National Security Council, and on the White House Council on Environmental Quality. I am personally very grateful to him for all of that service, as well as for what he did here. David, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. President. How about that, Richard Branson? Sir Richard's $3 billion commitment signed in this hall yesterday is front page news around the world. Your commitment this morning, along with Vinod Khosla, Jim Wolfenson, Steve Bing, and Ron Burkle, of $1 billion in green investments is simply remarkable, too. And I'm happy to report members of this conference have also made dozens of other commitments to help fight global warming. We've heard commitments to mobilize religious groups, college students, college presidents, corporate boards, farmers, cities. The list goes on. Josh Fink, a 28-year-old financial wizard, came to this conference and pledged $50,000 plus his very valuable time and energy toward helping protect the environment in the developing world. Adam Strum, publisher of Wine Enthusiast magazine, was inspired by the CGI mid-year meeting to run an article on the impact of global warming on vineyards. Now he's pledged $50,000 for public awareness on global warming. And the Appleton Foundation out of Canada was inspired by last year's meeting to launch a $1 million program to convert public transport vehicles to hybrids. Mr. President, my last 24 hours have been filled with an immensely gratifying number of thank yous from people who have used this conference to advance their work in fighting global warming and to educate themselves on this topic. But those thanks really belong to you, Mr. President, and so I pass them along here. Please know that there are hundreds and hundreds of people in this room, some of whom may never have the chance to express this personally, who are deeply grateful for your vision, energy, and commitment in creating this conference. And while I'm on the topic of thanks, I can't say enough to thank our two deputies in the Energy and Climate Track, Amy Christensen, a veteran of last year's conference, who provided incredibly valuable counsel, even as she took on an exciting new job at Google.org, where she was kept very busy, and Michael Terrell, who's been working 18-hour days with a remarkable blend of organizational skills, good judgment, and good cheer. I'm deeply grateful to both of them. Our energy and climate sessions were filled with dazzling dialogue, creative ideas, and strong opinions. From these sessions, three themes emerged. First, there are many steps people in this room can take today to reduce their own contributions to global warming. Simple things like video conferencing, buying energy-efficient appliances, and doing a home energy audit. Smart and strategic things like making people within organizations accountable for energy waste. In several panels, we heard suggestions for making energy use part of each employee's performance appraisal. And I think you'll be glad to know, Mr. President, that we were reminded not to forget about compact fluorescence. Mayor Rocky Anderson described how Salt Lake City saved tens of thousands of dollars each year by eliminating incandescent bulbs from city buildings. A second theme, companies are investing now and they are ready to invest more. John Doerr described his investments in the next generation of clean energy technologies and pledged another $100 million in new investments in this area. We heard about record growth in the solar and wind industries, about rapid advances in biofuels, about companies committed to finding new opportunities in this area. There was an almost palpable sense of excitement about the growth in clean energy markets. As John Podesta said, the opportunity is here, it's real, and it's accelerating. A third theme, and for many CGI members the most important, was the need for leadership from government to unleash these market forces. Brenda Davis of Johnson & Johnson said, "We've got to have government policy that puts economic value on greenhouse gas emissions, and it's backed by caps." Abby Joseph Cohen said that investors like Goldman Sachs are hearing complaints that regulations are not yet in place. Time and again, CGI members in our table discussions stressed that mandatory measures from government are an essential part of the solution to this problem. And our track sponsor, Julian Robertson, who knows something about money, noted that if the government leads by setting a limit on carbon pollution, a whole lot less money will be going from American wallets to other parts of the world. The past 2 days have been exciting, dynamic, and inspiring. Wangari Maathai brought us a powerful message about hope and the ability to meet great challenges. The past 2 days have also been rewarding. You asked for commitments, Mr. President, and CGI members delivered. They're leading by example, they're raising the bar, and they're helping point the way to lasting solutions. We leave today inspired, challenged, and ready to do our part to shape a clean energy future. Thank you.
Thank you, David. I just want to make two brief points about this area because I didn't get to attend some of the sessions. The first is about the economy. One of the great challenges for wealthy countries is to continue to discharge our responsibility to the global economy by keeping our markets open to products produced in poorer countries. We cannot do that if our own people lose confidence in the ability of the American market to function for them. If you look at America, our fundamental problem is we still have a relatively low unemployment rate but flat wages. First time we've ever had 5 years of productivity growth, 40-year high in corporate profits, stagnant wages. The reason is we haven't found a serious source of new good-paying jobs. The obvious answer is a commitment to a clean, independent energy future. If you look at Europe, the big problem is that the cost of preserving the social safety net has led to higher unemployment levels than is desirable. The obvious answer is a commitment to clean new jobs. If you look at the performance of the UK, the European economy most like ours, they have a comparable unemployment rate, but they haven't had wage stagnation. And I am convinced it's because they made a commitment to beat their Kyoto targets and created a whole range of new jobs. If you look at the developing world and you want to raise per capita income, you will have to spend a fortune and wait for a long time for the most remote villages to get centralized power grids. But if we went to decentralized power the way we went to decentralized cell phones, so you don't have to wait for the power lines to run out, and you had a commitment to solar energy, to wind energy, and to energy efficiency in the developing world, it could contribute to economic growth. So that's second thing I wanted to say for those of you who haven't made commitments yet. Many of you are involved locally in the welfare of your institutions of higher education. Our chief sponsor, Tom Golisano, has done an enormous amount of work in Rochester at the Institute of Technology there when I visited it. A lot of you do this. The colleges and universities in the United States and throughout the world have enormous potential to lead the way toward a clean energy future. In Minnesota earlier this year, two colleges, St. Olaf's and Carleton, had a contest to see who could have the biggest reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. It was fascinating to read. It read like a football saga. We got our windmill up first. Yeah, but we fixed our buildings first. Former President Bush and I just funded two green schools in New Orleans as a part of the Katrina rebuilding effort. All these school kids are going to learn as they go to school about how to do this. It will affect everything they do for the rest of their lives. So one of the things we need to do that I hope to get done by CGI but didn't finish is to get the colleges and universities in America in an organized way committed to greenhouse gas reductions in a way that reduces the cost of operations and, if you're still a parent of a college-age child, may help to ameliorate the tuition burden in the out years. So I ask those of you who haven't made a commitment yet, if you're looking for a place where you could have a quick turnaround and high return, that's it. Thank you very much, David. Now I'd like to ask our
President,
you're not done? I'm sorry.
We have three more commitments on climate change for you, Mr. President.
Okay. Oh, this is good. Walmart is making a commitment to improve the packaging of every product sold at Walmart stores through a supplier packaging scorecard and reward the system. The commitment is $1 million in the first year that will achieve a minimum of $100 million in cost savings. Right-sizing the packaging of just one Walmart store-owned line of toys, Kid Connection, just by doing that. Listen to this. This is unbelievable. Walmart saved 1,358 barrels of oil, 5,190 trees, and $3.5 million in transportation costs in 1 year. Now the company will measure how much packaging its 60,000 suppliers use in transport and will reward its suppliers according to how much they can reduce their environmental impact. The company expects that by 2013, the commitment will keep 213,000 trucks off the road in the United States every single year for a total cumulative savings of 66.7 million gallons of diesel fuel, saving the supply chain $3.8 billion by 2013. I rest my case. Thank you very much. Is Lee here? Come on up. Let's give him a hand. This is great. Now I'd like to ask Rick Federici, the President and CEO and Founding Chairman of the U.S. Green Building Council, and LaDonna Munzies, the CEO of Newland Communities, to come up here. They have made a commitment to help Americans make their homes more energy efficient through an informative online consumer resource center that will give its users practical, easy-to-use, credible information on the benefits of green homes, explaining how saving energy saves money, cuts greenhouse gas emissions, makes for healthier living. The Resource Center will be the cornerstone of a comprehensive year-long campaign by the Green Building Council and Newland Communities to educate consumers about the benefits of environmentally friendly, energy-efficient homes. Generally, green homes are 30 to 50% more energy efficient than traditional ones, and reports state that the green home marketplace may be at a tipping point. By 2007, by mid-year, 64% of all home builders surveyed reported they anticipated that they would be moderately or heavily involved in green building practices. The EPA ranks indoor air pollution among the top five environmental risks in the United States, and unhealthy air is found in up to 30% of new and renovated buildings, but not in green buildings. So I thank you for that. I'm proud that our presidential library has received a certificate for leadership in energy and environmental design and has cut its energy costs by 34%. As I get a little ahead, I'm going to do better than that. Thank you very much. Let's give them a big hand. This is great. Thank you. Let's see.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Let me say, as the owner of owners of the home that's over 100 years old, I can testify to how important this is. I mean, you know, in the week when I'm home alone and my senator's down there voting in Washington, I actually decided that I would personally see how hard it would be to replace all my light bulbs with compact fluorescent ones. It's not as easy as you think. I even called Jeffrey Immelt and said I was trying to buy GE bulbs made in America, but I needed more shapes and sizes. The point is, there are, and he said to me, well, get my market up and I'll make different bulbs. So it's a chicken and egg deal, but this is really important what they have done. You'd be amazed how many people want to do something, but they have a limited amount of time, and they just shouldn't have to go looking around, schlepping all over the universe, trying to figure out how they can get the job done. So this is really important. Thank you very much. And I have now, on at least two occasions during this CGI, perhaps embarrassed, but I meant to compliment both Barbara Streisand and Rupert Murdoch for finally finding something they agreed on. But I would like to ask Barbara Streisand to come up here and be recognized. She gave me the first $1 million for the Clinton Foundation to represent and help to facilitate the movement of the large cities group in drastically reducing their greenhouse gas emissions. We have now enrolled 32 of the 40 biggest cities in the world in a common commitment to drastically reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. I refuse to take any money, any public money from any of them, so I had to raise the money from contributors. Barbara gave me my first $1 million, and then Rupert Murdoch gave me $500,000, and that'll get us through the first year. So let's give her a big hand and ask her to come up. I told him we were going to get more out of him. She says Rupert's richer than she is and should give more. I knew we could get a little politics here if we waited long enough.
Where is Rupert?
Here you go. You may have to reissue Evergreen now with a new meaning. Now, I'm going to try again. I think we're going to our health group with Chris Jennings. Is that right? Is that next?
Mr. President.
This man has got more scars on him than I do because he was my principal health advisor when I was president. He's now head of Jennings Policy Studies, a healthcare consulting firm, and a knowledgeable and terrific public servant. Thank you, Chris. It's your turn.
Thank you, Mr. President. While I have worked for you now, either on or off the payroll for 15 years now, I am the only rookie a working chair group here at CGI, and I must tell you it has been an extraordinarily inspiring and rewarding experience, so thank you very much. I have to say that for all of us chairs, though, we have to recognize that we stand on the shoulders of your impressive CGI staff, the panelists, the moderators, the commitment presenters, in my case, the incomparable Donna Shalala, the talented volunteers, and of course, the incredible participants of this conference. And I absolutely must publicly acknowledge, and gratefully so, my deputy, Christoph. He is an amazing talent, and he's made his own commitment of his soul, his heart, his body, to make this the most successful health inaugural, since this is the first, the inaugural track, a great success for you, Mr. President. So thank you, Chris. Mr. President, as you know, we had three sessions on neglected disease threats, infrastructure, and business's role. At the heart of our sessions was the people who are afflicted with debilitating, all too often fatal diseases, robbing the world of the talents and economic contributions they can make. And the soul of our sessions was the speakers and participants from throughout the world who passionately care about them. It quickly became clear that this story is not just about the staggering numbers of the world's citizens overwhelmed by HIV, AIDS, TB, and malaria. And it's not just the story about 1 billion people who are afflicted with disabling, oftentimes stigmatizing, neglected tropical diseases, such as human hookworm infection and elephantiasis. And it certainly isn't just about chronic diseases, such as heart disease, and get this, which has become the number one cause of death in virtually all developing countries. And strikingly, there are now more overweight than undernourished people in the world. As compelling, as concerning as all these numbers are, our panelists, whether it was the moving words of our own President Jimmy Carter or Tanzania's impressive new President Jakaya Kikwete, brought home to our participants that it's all about the faces of dying children and sick mothers who haunt those who have seen them. They know that the vast majority of those who have died or have been disabled were assaulted by diseases that could have been, as you just pointed out, Mr. President, prevented or easily and cheaply treated. And they know that the tools that we need to get education, prevention, treatment, and cures are known, but simply not used well, or perhaps not at all. What struck me, and what I think struck us all, was the point made by both Nicaraguan Minister Margarita Gordillon and Iranian cardiologist Dr. Nizal Saraf Zardragan, that these challenges are all interconnected. How the lack of clean water, the fundamental basis of life, leads not only to the contraction of disease, but also to families' ability to care for themselves and to the well-being of their own nation. How HIV/AIDS and malaria are worsened by neglected tropical diseases. How chronic disease is actually a communicable disease because it is spread through globalization from us throughout the developing world. And of course, how disease is intrinsically linked to poverty and economic destabilization. And as frustrating as these realities are, the progress being made and the potential for so much more was a highlight again and again and again. To a large extent, we now know what works. We were continually told we no longer have any excuses for inaction. We know how to drill wells to provide clean water. But we also know that the so-called software or education to make sure that the wells must be maintained. And we need the education to ensure, for example, that clean buckets and clean hands are there to prevent the up to 3 million deaths of children each year due to diarrhea and dehydration. We know that a well-structured and community-sensitive infrastructure is the life's blood of a viable health delivery system, that it can be supported by locally trained medical paraprofessionals, delivered through creative transportation options like motorcycles and bikes, and sustained by solar-powered energy. We know that the effective administration of scarce resources is as important as having doctors and nurses, and that, as Faisal Abbad told us Wednesday, the next disease he'd like to see eradicated is bad management. We know that to be viable, we have to keep it simple. A poly pill that reduces the number of doses per day, for example, or the multiple uses of the same delivery platform for all diseases. Siloing for diseases might be understandable in terms of attracting research money or funding, but it does not maximize our reach to get care. We know that we must deal with the fact that prevention must and will be the key to our ability to cope with the growing epidemic of chronic disease. And we've learned, very inspiringly learned, that good health can be good business, and that businesses can be and are great partners for change. And best of all, Mr. President, I am pleased to report that we have already received over 60 commitments to address all these challenges throughout the world. Maybe not too bad for a rookie. But most important, we know that failure is no longer an option, and delay can no longer be excused. And as the Clinton Foundation's own Ira Magaziner and my friend said, we must move ahead and act, even while recognizing that we will make mistakes. Always knowing, though, if we take advantage of the skills, knowledge, and motivations of local communities, we will always do better than doing nothing at all. Mr. President, over 20 years ago, a terrible failure to expand our own horizons occurred: the explosion of the Challenger space shuttle. CGI participant and a close friend of yours and the first public servant that I had the pleasure to serve, John Glenn, called a small gathering of his staff into his room, and he told us with tears in his eyes, unfortunately like tears in my eyes, to never turn away from the opportunity, the privilege, to do something bigger than yourself, no matter the risk. Nothing could be a better message to and for this inspiring get-together. By words and particularly by deeds, Mr. President, you and so many and those in the audience today have heeded this call and will inspire others to eliminate barriers for every child of God to achieve their greatest potential. Thank you so very much.
Where's my mic?
Now we have a few health commitments. The first is a commitment from UNICEF, and I'd like to ask the Executive Director, Ann Veneman, who was Secretary of Agriculture in President Bush's first term, to come up here. I have had the honor to work with Ann and with UNICEF in my capacity as the UN envoy on tsunami relief, and it's a great organization, and you have done a terrific job in getting to the bottom of all the responsibilities you have. I thank you so much. UNICEF's new Accelerated Child Survival and Development Program will operate in 10 African countries where UNICEF and the national governments have found opportunities to cut the death rate among children. The program will eliminate bottlenecks that prevent desperately needed services from reaching children, creating packages with country-specific, cost-effective priority interventions like vaccinating children, promoting best feeding, giving vitamin A supplements, organizing community prenatal care. By 2009, the Accelerated Child Survival and Development Program will save an estimated 399,000 lives a year. Almost 6 million of the 11 million children who die every year could be saved. More than half of the children who die every year could be saved by low-tech, evidence-based, cost-effective measures like these, like vaccines, antibiotics, micronutrient supplements, insecticide-treated bed nets, improved family care, and breastfeeding practices. Each year, vitamin A supplementation alone saves over 250,000 lives. Oral rehydration prevents an estimated 1 million deaths. Immunization programs save the lives of 3 million children. So, I thank you, and Africa thanks you. With 10% of the world's population, but 42% of all the deaths of children under five. Thank you very much, Ann Veneman. This is a commitment from the De Beers family of companies. I'd like to ask Jonathan Oppenheimer, the chairman's office, Jennifer Oppenheimer, and the president of Tanzania, President Kikwete, who's here behind me, please come up here. There you are. The commitment is to create a community diamond partnership to encourage economic development and good health in Tanzanian communities with small-scale diamond mining. De Beers will work with Williamson Diamond Limited and the government of Tanzania to ensure that unregulated Tanzanian miners maintain good health and get their fair share of the wealth they create. By pushing for better regulation of informal mining, offering innovative smart wallet technology with third-party verification to make sure miners don't fall prey to rogue traders buying stones at prices well below their worth. Equally important, the Community Diamond Partnership will work to transform the communities surrounding the mines, offering health services to manage HIV, AIDS, and malaria, supporting sustainable farming, and providing training and education programs. The goal is to produce a model that could be replicated in other unmanaged small-scale diamond mining economies, including those in Sierra Leone, Angola, Guinea, and the DRC. This is a profoundly important thing. I have the honor of working in Tanzania on HIV and AIDS. I have a high regard for the new president and his predecessor. They're a well-organized, committed country doing good work, and they deserve this kind of support. And the idea that this is being done through mining, which has been such a source of exploitation and shame and destruction in Africa for too long, is a wonderful, wonderful thing. So I thank all of you. Congratulations. Mr. Oppenheimer said on the way down that reminded me that the principles could be applied to all forms of mining and not just diamonds. That's another example of an idea we could have for next year, so you guys could. Now I would like to ask to the stage Frank Sazanowski, the director of the Catholic Medical Mission Board, and Sister Pat Eck, the Catholic Medical Mission of the Catholic Medical Mission Board, to come up here. The Catholic Medical Mission Board is making a commitment worth $2 million over the next 2 years to solicit pharmaceutical company donations and volunteer medical staff to treat neglected tropical and chronic diseases in Honduras and Kenya. Volunteer nurses and physicians from the United States will use the donated medications to help diagnose illnesses and deliver the donated life-sustaining products to over 50,000 Hondurans alone. In Kenya, we will have the same sort of program where the total health expenditure today is just over $65 a person and accounts for about 4% of GDP. In both countries, there are just over one nurse per 1,000 people. Not enough. Part of our AIDS work in Kenya involves training and actually hiring new nurses to try to stop the collapse of the nation's healthcare efforts. So this is a very, very important commitment by the Catholic Medical Mission Board. Let's give them a big hand. Let us sign up. Thank you. Now I'd like to call on the chair of our Poverty Alleviation Working Group, Gail Smith, to take the microphone. She's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. She served on the National Security Council when I was in the White House between 1994 and 2001. We couldn't have done half of the good things we did in Africa without her. She's not responsible for any mistake I made, and she is now a massive asset to CGI. When we go to Africa, people believe we were cloned together. Gail, the floor is yours.
I knew you were going to do that, and I was going to say something about, and now we're both wearing these glasses, but you're not wearing yours this morning. So thanks a lot. Mr. President, I must. All right. I was getting real nervous here. I want to thank you. I want to thank exceptional moderators, panelists, and members. I also, given that global poverty is a huge problem, have two deputies, and I want to thank John Lyman and David Auerbach, who, with professionalism and a sense of humor, and assuming that I get through these remarks, have gotten us over the finish line. I also want to thank a team in New York that you've got behind you that is absolutely spectacular and compensates for the fact that, as you said in your opening remarks, you are indeed a nitpicker. Now, in all seriousness, Mr. President, the Global Poverty Alleviation Working Group this year gave us a glimpse of what the world could look like and reminded us that there are some things, like the poverty that denies our fellow citizens the rights and opportunities that we enjoy, that are bigger than all of us, things that trump politics, ego, and protocol. Mr. President, our discussions offered us a glimpse of what the world could look like if we, all of us, put into practice that fundamental belief we all espouse and all endorse, that belief in equality. Our working group focused on the simple fact that we can live in a world where no one lives on less than a dollar a day if we deliver on the right of the world's poor to equal access to the tools that have made the lives of those of us in this room productive, safe, and prosperous. Our panelists and moderators made clear that there are no unsurmountable barriers to that access. Even though we have yet to forge an agreement on global trade that can make the world's markets accessible to all of the world's producers, we heard from people on the ground who are providing the world's poorest farmers with access to the tools and information that can enable them to get out from under the yoke of poverty. In Ethiopia, subsistence farmers are being transformed slowly but surely into commercial producers. In India, rural kiosks are providing farmers with the information and technology they need to access and build local markets. We heard that there are no technological barriers to equal access. Affordable wireless internet can be and is being provided to rural communities in Asia and Africa. New smart tech water pumps are being provided to entrepreneurs across East Africa to expand the availability of safe water and create jobs at the same time. And importantly, we heard that there are no financial barriers to access that creativity and imagination cannot overcome. We found ways to use the market to generate financing for development and created the tools to provide microfinance and insurance against risk for local producers and investors. And our members made clear that there's no shortage of ideas about how we can do more to ensure that access is indeed afforded equally to all of the world's people. In less than 2 hours of table discussions, our members generated thoughtful proposals for aggregate buying, bundling services, an MBA Peace Corps, for microinsurance and consumer incentives, for internet-based producers forums, for socially responsible transactional charges to MP3 downloads, for microfinance bonds, and for a Community Reinvestment Act for the developing world. We focus on the principles that must guide us, the practices that can ensure our success, and the progress that is being made and in which we must, all of us, invest. Mr. President, it was your hope that by bringing together the communities who can solve the major challenges of our times, you might inspire us to work together and to commit to doing something more than simply to care. You have succeeded. This year, we had over $1 billion in new commitments for microfinance. And as you said at the beginning, that is a huge number, but we also had a number of commitments that are less reflected in dollars than they are in the spirit that can actually change the world. Our favorite story this year comes from two people who met at CGI, a young woman named Majora Carter we invited to speak on one of our panels, who works just miles from here to transform one of the poorest communities in our country, and a successful businessman by the name of Barry Siegel, who came to CGI for the first time because he wants to do something for this world. They are now partners in an effort to train people and create jobs to care for the first and only green spaces in the South Bronx. Our panelists, moderators, and members generated that inspiration, culminating in the fact that our table facilitators, and just so you know, these are all people we drew from our peer groups who volunteered their time to come broker those discussions. They committed last night to each adopt a commitment and to offer their time, expertise, and services to make sure that it's implemented. And just as we entered this room, there was a guy chasing us down the hall saying, we have a commitment we're going to do in the next 2 months to create a new instrument for philanthropy in Asia. The moral of this story, Mr. President, is that we have seen a world that might exist, a world of which we can be proud, a world in which the tools for change are available to all of the world's people, a world in which all are, in fact, equal citizens. And as more than one speaker reminded us, poverty can only be countered when we act on the simple fact that the poor are just as powerful as any in this room if they have equal access to the rights, to the markets, to the innovation, and to the financial tools that have afforded us our privilege and promise. We've taken practical, concrete steps towards building that world, and on behalf of the Global Poverty Working Group, we commit that we won't stop till we get there. Thank you.
We have some commitments I want to announce. First, I'd like to thank Gail Smith and remind you that a lot of the commitments that will be made in healthcare and that have been made in energy or in religious reconciliation will also be a very important part of the campaign against poverty. I was recently in your adopted country of Ethiopia. You can see what a shrinking violet Gail is. Over 20 years ago, when she was a young journalist, she went hundreds of miles alone with the rebel army in Ethiopia, writing stories about it. across the desert and through all the waste. It's an amazing story, but they still like her a lot there. Now, the Prime Minister of Ethiopia, Mr. Meles, says to me, he says, you know, I've been studying this alternative energy thing. We can grow sugar cane as well as the Brazilians, and that's an 8-to-1 conversion ratio. That's better than your corn. So he said, what we Africans should do is become the first oil-free continent when it comes to transportation. Then we should sell you our oil, which will reduce the tensions of the world and reduce global warming and make us have a sustainable economy. In other words, could you believe, I had this long discussion. I said, well, what about cellulosic fuel? He said, well, if it's good, you get a 4-to-1 conversion ratio. I'm sitting there talking to the Prime Minister of Ethiopia with a per capita country with a per capita income of about $2 a day, and he's got this thing down cold. And there are lots of people like that in Africa and Asia and Latin America that are thinking about this. We have this preconception about what people can and cannot do to lift their spirits. So I thank you, Gail, and all the committee for what you've done. I'd like to invite now, we have a couple of other commitments. John Hatch, the CEO of the Foundation for International Community Assistance, can't be here, I don't think, but we have in his, Scott Larkin and Fred Hochberg, I think, are here. And I'd like to ask them to come up. Somebody's here from this group, and this is a good commitment. I'm going to talk about whether you're here or not. Thank you. FINCA currently operates 38,000 banks in 21 countries. They have committed to expand into 10 new markets, including China, Brazil, Turkey, and Pakistan, to be operating 100,000 village banks within 5 years, serving 1 million people, a commitment worth $40 million over the next 5 years, to provide financial services to the poorest of the poor and to those living where there are no other formal financial institutions, and to help to create community-run, community-focused credit and savings associations. As microfinance matures, the Foundation for International Community Assistance is bringing services to communities that previously were untouched, believing that microfinance can be the leading edge of a global drive to eradicate poverty. Let's give them a big hand.
You should both sign them.
Now I'd like to ask Dr. Iqbal Survey and the Survey Family Foundation to come up. They have made a $10 million commitment over the next 5 years to establish the Social Entrepreneurship Foundation in South Africa to help social entrepreneurs fight poverty and encourage tolerance between diverse communities. Now, I personally am grateful for this because I helped to establish a city year chapter in Johannesburg in South Africa. We now have 200 young black and white South Africans working together on social entrepreneurship. The foundation intends to support existing social entrepreneurs in their fight against poverty, especially among poor urban and rural blacks, and to promote greater tolerance, and will convene a conference on social entrepreneurship and poverty alleviation in South Africa to begin. Thank you very, very much, Doctor. For personal reasons, this is one of my very favorite commitments of the whole conference. I'd like to ask Bob Johnson, the founder of BET and the CEO of RLJ Companies, Nathaniel Barnes, ambassador and permanent representative of the United Nations of Liberia, Deborah Lee, the CEO of BET, Rodney Slater, my former Secretary of Transportation, Cicely Tyson, Chris Tucker, Jeffrey Wright, and anybody else Bob wants to bring up here to come up here. I want to take that. And I'll explain why they're all here. Thank you. In Clarence Avant. Thank you. Thanks, Jeff. Thank you, Rodney. This is a $30 million commitment to renew the historic link between United States African American business community and other community leaders in Liberia. Bob Johnson has committed to lead a high-level delegation of African American leaders to Liberia to discuss direct investment in the country with President Johnson Sirleaf's priorities, with business leaders, doctors, engineers, lawyers, and entertainers. They commit that they will raise $30 million through direct investment and donations and establish a permanent group to work expressly on behalf of Liberia and the Liberian people to spur investments globally. Those of you who heard President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf at the beginning of this meeting had to have been immensely impressed with her. She was a distinguished World Bank official. She went home and presented herself as a candidate. As far as I know, she'd never run for public office before. She won a resounding victory over one of the most charismatic and famous people in her country. But Liberia has suffered greatly as a result of 14 years of terrible war and conflict. And it's going to take more than an exceedingly able president. My foundation has agreed to help the president with HIV and AIDS, and I recently went to Liberia. So I called her in advance. I said, I told her the truth. I said that Hillary had met her and been so impressed with her, I was ordered to do whatever she wished me to do. And she said, I want you to meet with my university students. So I met with these immensely impressive young people, all dressed up, very well turned out, asking the most penetrating questions. And then, and Mignon Moore's laughing, she was there with me. We're driving out of town, and I noticed that not 20% of the buildings in the capital, Monrovia, had electricity yet. I have no idea how those young people prepared themselves to look so grand under such extremely adverse circumstances. 80% of Liberians now live below the poverty line. Last year, the country only had $85 million in revenues. They have been devastated by the worst kind of oppression and looting. And the reason I love this story is that a lot of those kids I met reminded me of a young Bob Johnson who came out of the American South and figured out how to do what he did. So Bob comes up to me after he sees the president. He says, is she as good as I think she is? Is she for real? I said, yeah, she's really something. He said, well, you know, Liberia was founded by freed American slaves. And I think now we need a second African-American diaspora to go back to Liberia and have all these rich black people lift their economy. If there's just 3 million of them, surely we can do it in next to no time. So thank you very much. I bless you. Thank you. This is great. Here's another thing I love about CGI. So Bob and I are sitting there feeling smugly and self-congratulatory, and Jeffrey says, you know, Sierra Leone is right next door. And tell him what you said about fighting in the Revolution.
Well, it was founded as by freed American slaves who fought with the British during the American Revolution and ended up in Nova Scotia, and climate was better in Sierra Leone, I think, so ended up there.
So that means we can get the British to help us with Sierra Leone. That's good.
All of us, absolutely.
Thank you. Bless you all. Thank you.
Wait, Bob. Let's take this.
Now I would like to ask Rob Malley to take the microphone. Rob chaired our Ethnic and Religious Conflict Working Group. He comes with a first-hand perspective as the Middle East and North African Program Director of the International Crisis Group. He served in my second term on our National Security Council. He was heavily involved in the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations and the 2000 Camp David summit. And his passion for justice for the Palestinians was so great, and his reputation for fairness so immense, that he was sometimes known as the only Jewish member of the Palestinian delegation. The floor is yours.
Mr. President, why is it that some diverse societies are able to overcome their differences and live in relative peace and harmony, whereas in others, differences persist and end up in deadly conflict? Why is it that a child born today in Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Egypt, is far more likely than a few decades ago to grow up fearing the West? And why is it that a child born here in the United States today is far more likely than a few decades ago to live and grow up feeling threatened by Islam? And why is it that some conflicts that appear to be intractable, like the South African conflict, were resolved, whereas others that whose resolution always seems just within reach, like the Israeli-Arab conflict, go on and on and on? Those are the questions that our sessions looked at. Fascinating, formidable questions. And I want to thank my deputy, Mickey Bergman, who gave me a tremendous hand and without whom I couldn't have done any of this. And I want to thank everyone here, because those who participated in these panel discussions and those who were at the tables did more than simply point the way to how we could answer these questions. They led the way. Because in everything I'm going to mention now, for each of the ideas I'll mention, somebody stepped up, made a commitment on the spot, and I just got one even as I was walking up here. So what are the answers they suggested? Number one, focus on youth. There's a battle going on for their souls and their hearts and their minds, and sometimes we look as if we're not even in the starting block. How do you get to them? You aim high and you aim young. Many of the people in the panels were telling us, let's try to get into the curriculum for very young age children, intercultural, interfaith teachings. Let's engage with immigrant communities to help forge these new curricula. Let's have more exchange programs between Arabs and Americans and others. And again, on each one of those, we had people coming up and saying they would fund programs. Secondly, media, pop culture, movies, sports. Because we're not witnessing a clash of civilizations. We're witnessing a clash of ignorances. People who don't know each other and therefore fear one another. What one of our panelists said, which I thought was he was quoting, is trying to explain why it's so important to understand what matters to others. And he said, we are most violent when others violate what we hold most dear. And therefore we have to know and learn what others hold dear, or we will have more and more violence. And how do we do that? With movies. Movies about the Middle East, and Jeff Skoll, as you know, has already done some, and he's going to be doing more as he committed. Television shows. Let's do to Muslims what the Bill Cosby show did to African Americans. Let's humanize them, and let's break down the stereotypes and the caricatures. Let's train journalists who could be able to explain things in a way that also will break down the stereotypes, and let's have more exchange programs between journalists. And let's use music, and this is the commitment I just got walking up here from Salman Ahmed, a rock star, as most of you know, who's committing to have concerts throughout South Asia to promote greater religious, political, and cultural understanding. We also have to bring religion back into our public discourse, and also in our discourse about conflict resolution. This was mentioned last year by Secretary Albright. It was mentioned again this year. Like it or not, religion matters, and it matters to many people around the world. How do we do it? We bring them to the table. We have honest interfaith dialogue, and we speak to people on the other side, and we bring them to the table at the time of the political negotiations. It can be done, and it's being done more and more. Engage with people we don't agree with. We don't like it. We don't like what they have to say. But they're the ones who often have the constituencies, who have the resources, who know how to speak to people. We have to communicate with them. We have to engage with them. We have to do it. Otherwise, we're leaving large segments of the population beyond our reach. But the biggest how of all is what all of you in this room can do. What people with small steps or big steps can do, the most fortunate among us, most of all. It's not self-evident, particularly in this issue. You can't really quantify the results. How do you know when you've broken down a stereotype? How do you know when a caricature is no longer guiding our actions? How do you know whether conflict between Islam and the West is receding? But it matters. If we're not doing better at conflict prevention, conflict mitigation, conflict resolution, if we're not doing better at building bridges between the Muslim world and the West, we can forget about expanding healthcare in those conflict areas, we could forget about alleviating poverty, and we could forget about cooperation between different nations on issues such as climate change. It's not easy, but it's been done. And I want to mention the case of Jeffrey Swartz, who is the head of Timberlane, and who face this question: what does making boots have to do with Darfur? Economically, it made no sense. How does he explain it to his shareholders? But he said he faced a choice. One option was to be engaged in illogical action and helping the people of Darfur, and the other one was to be missing in action. He chose, and because all of you are here, you chose too. I want to speak about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict because it overshadowed, in a way, so many of our sessions. It's a broken record to say that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is at the heart of so much, but it's a broken record because it's broken so many lives. Terrorism is not going to cease if we resolve it. Muslims may still be angry. We'll still have problems. There'll still be alienation among Muslim communities in the West. But there's no single step we could take that would make a bigger difference than resolving the Arab-Israeli conflict. This was the panel discussion that generated the most passion, the most controversy. It was the most difficult we had. And there was not that much that our three panelists, a Lebanese, an Israeli, and a Palestinian, agreed on. But I can't resist saying the one thing they all agreed on unanimously and without any hesitation. Just four words: bring back President Clinton. Yeah. I'd like to end on a more personal note. My father's Egyptian. I'm Jewish. I was born in New York. I was raised in France. So I know something about being culturally and religiously conflicted. And still, I learned something working with President Clinton and with Senator Clinton about tolerance. They taught me a thing or two. In watching them over the years, not once did I see either one of them look down upon, speak down to, or even think down about another culture, another race, another faith. And when you're trying to make a different world, That, Mr. President, makes a world of difference. Thank you very much.
I'd like to invite to the stage first Gareth Evans, the President of the International Crisis Group, Dr. Hamza Alkholi, the Chairman and CEO of the Alkholi Group, and anyone else who wishes to come up here involved in the partners here, the International Crisis Group, the Alkholi Foundation, Yara Lee and George Gunn Third Foundation, and the Radcliffe Foundation, which I know my good friend Frank Juster is behind. I want to thank them for this commitment worth $900,000 over 3 years. The International Crisis Group, with top-level international figures, will work to build a just and lasting peace in the Middle East by fomenting broad political support needed to build this peace. They have already convened a brainstorming session at the UN earlier this month, and plan to convene a high-level group of former American government officials to generate bipartisan support for Middle East peace efforts, to produce a series of reports and briefing on the conflict to be presented to policymakers. After the troubles in Lebanon, the frustrations after the recent elections, all the ups and downs in the last 2 years, all of us who have ever dealt with this know that there will be no ultimate security for Israel until this is resolved, and that other wealthier people will play games with the poor and often brutalize Palestinians until this is resolved. And we all know more or less what the resolution will be. I have never dealt in my life with something. It's like doing a math problem where everybody knows the answer and no one will give you a pencil to solve the problem. And so this is a good thing that these two good people are doing. Thank you, Hamza. Thank you, Gareth. It's great to see you both. Please, thank you. Now I'd like to invite John Marks, the president of Search for Common Ground, Kamran Elayan, a philanthropist and entrepreneur, Deborah Berger, president of Unbound Philanthropy, and anyone else who's supposed to be up here with them. The organizations involved in this project are Search for Common Ground, the Alan B. Slifka Foundation, Kamran Elayan, and Unbound Philanthropy. They have made a commitment to communicate to millions of people the ideas and values of coexistence, mutual understanding, and reconciliation. This idea came out of one of the religious and ethnic conflict working sessions on Thursday, where the idea was proposed and the money pledged to bring together a number of world-renowned influential people to create a series of public service announcements to promote tolerance and reconciliation worldwide. Archbishop Tutu and Cicely Tyson, both of whom have participated, obviously, in this year's CGI, will be among those featured alongside musicians, athletes, and other well-known figures. So I thank them for doing this. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, studies have shown that Search for Common Ground's work are one of the critical sources of public awareness of the peace process and has helped to reduce suspicion and rumors that can lead to violence. So let's give them a big thanks and wish them well.
I'll tell them.
Yeah.
Good morning. I just wanted to say that we felt so many amazing moments in here. And I'm sure you had a lot of those moments that not only got you emotional, not only brought tears in your eyes when you heard, for example, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, what a wonderful message he had. We believe that those kind of messages, with the cooperation from CGI, need to be heard by many people in different parts of the world. And if we could get some clips and snippets from that, why not provide it as PSA to a number of different cultures and countries?
Thank you, Sam. Thank you. Yes. John just told me that all of you should consider yourselves potential interviewees for this project. I would like to invite the 2006 Olympic gold medalist Joey Cheek, founder of the Where Will We Be campaign, to come up here. This is a fascinating commitment. Come on up. This commitment is to unite a majority of 2008 Olympians to speak with one voice, to apply political pressure, and build partnerships with NGOs to help end the crisis in Darfur by the Summer Olympics onset in 2008. And the proposal is to assemble a core group of elite international athletes to travel to Sudan, film a documentary of their experiences on the ground, to raise media attention and develop as a source of recruiting for more athletes. To localize the message, lead a global public relations campaign, hold international screenings of the film. Each athlete will return to his or her home country and share the experience with the media, call upon others to join. To work to unite a majority of 2008 Olympians to speak with one voice, to apply political pressure, to build these kinds of partnerships with NGOs so that the crisis can be ended by the Summer Olympics of 2008. Let me also say that as he might say, the Olympians will reach collectively an audience of almost 4 billion people worldwide because of the fascination with the Olympics. And we know that one of the problems the United Nations is having is that individual governments don't want to commit to expand the African Union force or to replace it or to fund an expansion or replacement in the absence of the approval of the Sudanese government. Athletes bringing this kind of public attention, given their importance in countries all over the world, could help to change many, many governments' policies, perhaps a lot more than my endless round of private meetings have been able to do so far. So I am profoundly grateful, and I thank you, Joey, for doing this. Let's give him a big hand. Ladies and gentlemen, we're almost done now. Each one of these commitments highlights a great source of promise, but also reminds us that the whole reason we're here is that we live in an interdependent world that's been good to us, but is fundamentally unstable, unequal, and unsustainable. And a lot of our commitments illustrate that. One in particular I want to mention that deals with sustainability because it caught my eye was the Global Partnership for Afghanistan, a very old nation with a very rich history which has been torn to smithereens by conflicts since the Soviet invasion nearly 30 years ago now. Now its moderate Muslim democracy is once again threatened by a resurgent Taliban in the south and an explosion of poppy growing, which increased 60% last year and now produces 92% of the world's poppy for opium and heroin. The global partnership is the essence of what this CGI is all about. They said, we want to do something specific about it. They propose to partner with local farmers to launch 100 commercially viable orchard and woodlot businesses, each projected to generate an income sufficient to support a family of eight now living in poverty, with a rate of return on the endeavor higher than the same people could earn by cultivating poppies. It's a huge deal. It gives Afghanistan a better chance, and it means less opium and less heroin on the streets of cities all over the world. Now, keep in mind, this is also a model which is infinitely expandable. So if any of you haven't made a commitment yet, here's something you can invest in that what you know is going to work if it happens, because the criteria says that the return has to be greater than they would earn growing poppy on the same amount of land. So thank you very much for that. Almost every commitment in some way or another seeks to reduce the impact of inequality, which we know is staggering across the globe and even within developing countries. Half the world's people still live on less than $2 a day. Chelsea told me this morning that Fortune had just published its annual list of the 100 richest Americans, and for the first time, they're all billionaires. And the poorest one is worth a paltry $2 billion. And yet, poverty among working people has gone up in this country. So this inequality is a problem that is getting worse and will eventually challenge existing democracies and coherent societies, as well as serve as enormous barriers to perfecting human relations in emerging economies. A lot of our commitments deal with that. I want to mention one. The Sanam Qureshi Foundation partnered with the renowned children's rights activist Craig Kielberger and his organization Free the Children to adopt a village in the Masai Mara, of Kenya. They're going to provide several new schools and essential community services, including clean water. And I mention this because they're able to help 1,000 children and adults for the relatively modest sum of $68,000. Again, this is a replicable model. So if you care about inequality and you don't have a fortune to spend, but you'd like to do something to change the reality of people's lives on the ground, this is an example. And Kenya, it's very important because when the new administration came in Kenya, they said one of the dumbest things that happens in poor countries all over the world, and one reason we wound up with so many kids in radical madrasas in Pakistan, is that poor countries can't afford to fund their education system, so they charge the families of the poorest kids to send their kids to school in country after country. They abolished those fees in Kenya. Guess what? In 30 days, another 1 million kids showed up. Within 6 months, 2 million more children had shown up to the schools. But they didn't have schools, they didn't have teachers, they didn't have materials. They never dreamed it would be that explosive. So here is something you can do at an affordable price to have a direct and tangible impact on inequality. Finally, the current world is unsustainable because of two things we've discussed: the imminent threat of climate change and the persistence of religious, racial, and ethnic divides. What Richard Branson did here is truly wonderful, but you don't have to have $3 billion to commit over 10 years to replicate it. It'll get a lot of press because of the staggering dollar amount and because he is brilliant and charismatic. But the ultimate lesson is, how did he get this money in the first place? Because he understands how this system works. The most important thing Richard Branson has done is to remind us that, yes, we need government changes. Yes, we need rule changes. But for those of us who aren't in and can't make those changes except to vote for different policies when we get the chance in our respective countries, there is today a staggering set of economic opportunities that will yield good returns on investment to reduce the threat of global warming, create new jobs, start new businesses, promote greater equality, as well as a sustainable environment. That is the real lesson of the Branson Commitment, and therefore all of us can participate in that going forward. Finally, in the continuing fight against religious, racial, and ethnic hatreds, the violence and terror which often accompany them, we have to remember the stunning impact on all of us of Bishop Tutu. His personal example, his unifying words, his reconciling spirit. Not all of us can be him, but all of us can support him and people like him. He's too good a man to mention it and never even asked to be considered here, but he has established a foundation for peace that will enable him to continue his work now that he has no organized clerical responsibilities or any responsibilities within the South African government. He's got to raise a few million dollars to fund it. Hillary and I are going to support him personally. If you want to do something in the area of reconciliation where you can amplify your words in a huge echo chamber, even a modest contribution can help Bishop Tutu to put his stake in the ground and to give that speech. I will never forget as long as I live that religion is like a knife. And if you slice a loaf of bread, it's good. And if you slice somebody's hand off, it's bad. I will never forget that. The reason that we started this whole thing is that the world is unequal, unstable, and unsustainable. That governments alone can't move us from inequality to equal opportunity, from instability to shared responsibility, from unsustainability to integrated communities where we live in harmony with nature and each other, and that all of us can do it. All we tried to do here is to create a small piece of common ground in a highly contentious world. Common ground where people like Laura Bush and Bill Clinton, Rupert Murdoch and Barbara Streisand, Muslim, Jews, and Christians, a conservative Latin American president like Alvaro Uribe, and a populist one like Evo Morales, the great winners of the 21st century, the Gates, the Buffetts, the Scotts, Carlos Slim, Bob Johnson, Richard Branson, and those who represent the poor, the sick, the unlettered, where they can all stand together and make common cause, where we can state our differences directly and respectfully, clarify our thoughts, and maybe most important of all, leave our useless resentments behind so we can learn from each other and lift our vision to a better place. Seems to me that's what this interdependent world demands of us, a relentless quest for new communities of equal opportunity, shared responsibility, and genuine belonging. Cynics may say we are latter-day Don Quixotes and Sancho Panzas. I say, if you will build me another windmill, I'll be glad to tilt at it, and the world will be a safer place. All I know is that every time I go somewhere, I see all over again, like I did in that little building that was one of the few with electricity in Liberia, that intelligence, ability, and dreams are evenly distributed. And I know something else, having lived a long time now. Every denial of our common humanity, from a terrorist tragedy to the daily miseries of life, leads to heartache, and every affirmation of it brings some measure of joy and peace. So I'm really grateful to the people we celebrated here, to people like my friend Wangari Maathai, who rose against all the odds on the strength of her spirit, and whose book about it will move you to tears. But I'm grateful to people you and I will never know who do the same thing every day. Otherwise, the wars would be greater, the deaths would be greater, and we wouldn't even come here. I met in Lesotho. I took Bill and Melinda Gates to Lesotho with me, and we looked at this attempt we're putting together to have a national testing campaign to get everybody over 12 to be tested for HIV and AIDS by promising no discrimination and absolute access to medical care and medicine when they need it. And so to do this, since you have the right to opt out, we had to find partners who would go into every little village and be good models. We had one guy who was a national boxing coach who still had a great, though very frail, body whose CD4 count got down to 4 and was now 750 alive because of our program. But the most moving person was a young girl who had been raped and infected. In a traditional society where she could have been stigmatized and broken forever. And we're not talking about the streets of New York here. Here's a woman high in a village in Lesotho, going in and looking into to the faces of her countrymen and women, said, "I'm HIV positive. You know how I got it? I was raped. Am I ashamed? No. Was this my fault? No. Am I going to be a victim? No. And neither should you. But you shouldn't infect anybody either. Now, if I can stand up here and tell you that I'm HIV positive because I'm a rape victim, the least you can do is to be tested and find out if you are and do the right thing." Now, she'll never be a millionaire, and she'll never be a movie star, but she may save lives beyond what all of us will do. There are people like them everywhere, and they deserve our support. When I went to Nelson Mandela's 88th birthday party recently in South Africa, I was supposed to show up at this hospital event with him, and he sent me over this shirt to wear that had his prison number on it, 46664. So I showed up with Mandela's prison shirt. He's a lot better performer than I'll ever be. He knew that was a good thing to do. But it reminded me of something he said, and I want to read it to you. "To be free is not merely to cast off one's chains, but to live in a way that respects and enhances the freedom of others." That's what this CGI deal is all about. That's why you're here. That's what we're trying to do. Madiba spent a third of his life behind steel bars. Today, 3 billion people are trapped behind the bars of poverty, lack of health care, war, terror, environmental devastation, and the imminent specter of global warming. To live in a way that respects and enhances the freedom of others requires that we break through those bars and cast off each other's chains. Bishop Tutu reminded us that sort of the essential wisdom of Africa about the human condition is captured in the word Ubuntu. He didn't give you the literal translation because it is almost mystical. The literal translation of Ubuntu in English is, "I am because you are." Now, when we finished sequencing the human genome, we discovered the astonishing fact that genetically every breathing human being on the planet is more than 99.9% the same. The further astonishing fact that if you took clustered pure ethnic groups, we have the president of Iceland and the first lady here. If you took, let's say, 100 Icelanders who had never lived anywhere else, they were 100% Icelanders back as far as we could trace, and you put them with 100 Bolivian Indians who had always had intermarriage, and you took any tribe in Africa and you put them together, and you found some Sikhs in the north of India who had always intermarried. There was no ethnic differences as far as we knew. You put all these groups together, the genetic differences within each group among the individuals would be greater than the differences in the genetic profile of the groups from one another. Now that's stunning, right? Now, think about this, every one of us. It's easy for us to point the finger and say we wish the Venezuelan president wouldn't say hateful things. We hope the Iranian president will moderate. How we wish the Israelis and the Hamas would negotiate. You think about how much of your life, your own life, is organized around that 0.1%. You had better grades than somebody else. You're better looking than somebody else. We're arrogant enough to think that those of us that have a lot of money are so much better than that poor girl that's going up into that village in Lesotho trying to get people to get tested for AIDS. Now you think about it. All of us, we organize more than 90% of our lives, our thoughts, our energies, our self-image. We all do it around that 0.1%. Even the most liberal, social-minded, giving, unselfish, we always think about what is it. Barbara got the voice of a generation out of 0.1% of her genetic pool. All of us do that. We have lived our whole lives that way. So we come here for a couple of days to remember Ubuntu. If we were alone on this planet, alone, and we were the most beautiful, the most brilliant, the most powerful, the most wealthy, and the longest lived ever person ever to exist, if we were alone, we would not amount to a hill of beans, and if we did, nobody would know it. So, Ubuntu, for us it means the world is too small, our wisdom too limited, our time here too short to waste any more of it in winning fleeting victories at other people's expense. We have to now find a way to triumph together. And so you have here. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for attending the 2006 Clinton Global Initiative Conference. Please travel safely. We look forward to seeing you next year. Thank you.